Justice in St. Thomas Aquinas' thought is a vast subject, and I can't hope to do it justice in this session, but I'll try to at least give us the skeleton. And that's actually one of the things that's so great and so useful, I think, about Aquinas' philosophical and theological system, is that it may not give you the final answer to any particular question, but it gives you the skeleton that allows you to stand up and understand the whole. And so by just getting the skeleton of justice, hopefully then we can go deeper if there are interests in some of the particular areas, or at least you will understand how it all fits together in his mind. In brief, we find justice defined in the Secunda Secundae of the Summa Theologiae as a moral virtue, as we heard from Dr. Gorman yesterday. Aquinas puts it this way: it's the habitus by which one renders to each his due, or ius in Latin, I-U-S, by a constant and perpetual will. So note that, first of all, justice is in the will. It's in the highest of our appetites, the rational appetite. And to say that we're talking here about a virtue means that we're presupposing Aquinas's teleological understanding of the human person. Morality, then, for Aquinas, isn't just about obeying rules, and in the end, neither is justice. Rather, the rules are for the sake of guiding and educating us in the good so that we will attain to our true end, our true flourishing, our perfection, our happiness. And so this lecture links up very nicely with Dr. Long's lecture that we just had about the common good. So discussing the virtue of justice is important for Aquinas as a part of his wider account of how a person should act in order to come to one's final end. So this paper will have three parts. First, I'm going to examine the ius, that's I-U-S again, and what it tells us about justice. Then I'll talk about what grounds a ius in natural law, positive law, the law of nations. And finally, in the third part, I'll examine the different species or parts of justice, according to Aquinas, to see just how vast the field of justice is in Aquinas's thought. So the first part, Aquinas on ius. We've just heard Aquinas's definition of justice as a virtue, which refers to rendering to each his ius. The translator, the typical translation that one often finds of Aquinas, renders this as do in this phrase, but more generally translates ius as right. It could also be translated as the just, or even as law, or as Dr. Gorman noted yesterday, what is right, or the fair. It's a term drawn from the Roman legal tradition, and so the fact that Aquinas puts it in the center of his definition of the virtue of justice, which generally follows the outline of Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics, indicates to us that it's a way that Aquinas is synthesizing different traditions about justice. So the Roman legal tradition, the Augustinian tradition, into or with this Aristotelian tradition about justice as a moral virtue. Aquinas' point in setting it up this way is to say that we judge whether an action is just by whether we have rendered to another his due or ius. So what is this due, this ius, this right? Aquinas investigates this in question 57 of the Secunda Secundae, where we learn that the ius is the object of justice. That's an extremely important point because for Aquinas, virtues are differentiated according to their objects. So along the way, in making this clarification about ius, Aquinas shows us what is distinct with respect to justice. And so I'm going to enumerate two principal features about justice. First, justice is with respect to another. So this is text A on your handout. It is proper to justice, as compared with the other virtues, to direct man in his relations with others. because it denotes a kind of equality, as its very name implies. Indeed, we are wont to say that things are adjusted, adequated, when they are made equal, for equality is in reference of one thing to another. So, we are not properly speaking just with respect to our hands and our feet. I'm not just to my stomach when I eat healthy food. We're properly speaking just with respect to others. Now, this truth leads, then, Aquinas to note how justice is different from other moral virtues. And this is text B, which is a long text, which I'm not going to read out loud, but it's basically making the point that other moral virtues perfect man with respect to a measure that is interior to him, whereas justice is with respect to a measure that is exterior. So think of temperance. The food we eat is not temperate in itself. The diners who sit down to eat are the ones who need to be temperate. That is, with temperance, the rule or measure is interior to the person, the actor, and depends in some degree on the particularities of the person. So temperance for an NFL linebacker who's in the middle of his training season, he's been practicing for 8 hours, he sits down to eat a huge meal, is different than temperance for a philosophy student who spends all day sitting in the library. There's also a difference because whether an act is temperate depends on how it is done by the person acting. You can, for example, eat modestly of the first course of a nice meal because you're intending to gorge yourself on the main course. Now, objectively speaking, you might look from the outside and say, oh, well, that was a temperate act. But in fact, it wasn't temperate at all because you're doing it for the sake of intemperance. Justice is different than this because the measure is, in a certain sense, really outside of you. It's with respect to this use. And this brings us to the second key aspect of justice. It's not just with respect to another. It has this objective character. The object of justice is in a sense, independent of the person acting. Although we can still speak about, insofar as it's a virtue that orders the will, there is a just way to do an act of justice, but we can understand, nonetheless, an act as just with reference to this exterior reality. So this way of conceiving the object of justice has three important corollaries. The first is that as modern people, we tend immediately to think of right or rights in what we could call a subjective sense. My rights, individual rights. That is, rights with a focus on the person who possesses them. In a radical form, this could even be conceived as a kind of property of persons, or a character that belongs to a person, of persons even abstracted from all of their relations, whether relations to other individuals or relations to political communities or states, even persons abstracted from the end of the person and from the common good. Dr. Long made a very nice point about this very thing. Modern rights language often conceives of persons as kind of moral monads, as if articulating a right is all you need to say about it. In a more moderate form, a form that's maybe more amenable to Aquinas' thought, you could think of rights as referring to a person's moral faculty to claim as his own certain objects or certain liberties and so forth. This isn't necessarily inconsistent with Aquinas' view, I think. But even there, I think we should note that his terminology is less subjective, less concerned with thinking about rights in terms of who possesses a right, and is more concerned about the right as what is due, something that in a way is out there, which does belong to someone. By taking this more objective view of what a use is, Aquinas is then able to integrate many different species or types of justice into one overarching framework. The same use, the same sort of reality is at stake in a commercial exchange as we can also talk about in the criminal law, where we're talking about someone being deprived of, say, life or bodily integrity or liberty to worship God. Okay, a second corollary that flows from Aquinas's definition of use in this way. Justice is, properly speaking, only between persons, because only persons can be do something under the title of justice. Or to put it differently, only persons can possess a use. Now, this is controversial in some quarters today. Do dogs and cats have rights? Some people would be quick to say yes. Does Harumbe the gorilla have rights? I was just asked to comment on a media piece yesterday, sitting in the back of the, I got an email asking for comments on whether Harumbe has rights under justice. Some journalist was writing an article about this. So from Aquinas' perspective, the answer can be boiled down to the fact that justice has to do with a certain equality. Our common human nature, or more specifically for Aquinas, the fact that we are all rational animals, individuals of a rational nature, is what most fundamentally grounds the equality of justice from a philosophical perspective, and thus the use or do that makes a claim on us. So human beings are unique among the visible creation as the kinds of beings capable of a kind of self-possession, a self-domination by way of reason. We're not simply moved by force or external stimuli or a kind of blind impulse, but we act as self-movers by choice. And philosophically, that accounts for our equality. Now, we can speak about justice metaphorically with respect to non-persons, but it remains metaphorical. It's not justice in the proper sense. So to talk about being just to the earth is not properly speaking a form of justice. And actually, interestingly, Pope Francis's encyclical on this point, Laudato Si, does refer environmental concerns to human beings, future human generations. So properly speaking, we're being just to other people when we respect the environment. We're not just being just to the earth. A third corollary. For Aquinas, because all human beings are equal, precisely as rational animals, and we could even now expand this to make a theological point, because human beings are made in God's image and are potential members of the body of Christ, or the city of God, you might say, justice extends beyond the human political community. Now, this is a point where Aquinas is disagreeing with Aristotle. Aristotle thought that really justice was between citizens in one political community. Aquinas brings to bear on this question the Augustinian tradition, seeing all human beings as potential members of the city of God. In other words, for Aquinas now, justice takes on a universal scope, universal to the whole human race, applying as at least a minimum condition for our actions with respect to every other person. What then is the relationship between jus and law? Especially where we're speaking of a written law, Aquinas explains that the jus is the measure and intelligible form of a written law, in the same way that an artisan's idea of a table that he's going to make is the mental exemplar and measure of his success in putting a table together in with pieces of wood. So both jus and law are, for Aquinas, grounded in the real order. This is where we can trace justice back to its metaphysical foundations, you might say. And as we've heard repeatedly now, Aquinas defines law as an ordination of reason for the common good made by one who has care of the community and promulgated. So Law is not just an exercise of will, it's an ordination of reason with respect to an ordering in reality. And its governing principle is wisdom. So Aquinas likewise offers a definition of justice in terms of order. And this is text C on your handout. Justice, by its nature, implies a certain rectitude of order, inasmuch as it implies a right order in man's act, and thus justice is placed amongst the virtues, either as particular justice, which directs a man's act by regulating him in relation to another individual man, or as legal justice, which directs a man's acts by regulating them in their relation to the common good of a multitude. So what is true here is also true about the use, or what is due to another. That object of justice depends on, first, the overarching order in the cosmos, which is laid out according to God's wisdom, and that is therefore intelligible and teleological. It comes from God's wisdom, and all things are ordered back to God, especially man. And also, this shows us that there is a relationality that is at stake in justice. So insofar as each of us is a member of various ordered wholes, for example, a family, a neighborhood, a political or civil community, the whole human race, the city of God, the body of Christ. So justice can then be understood as a relational virtue within the overarching order of the cosmos, and also even within the very concrete historical order in which I find myself. Now, it's not often noted, but this concrete and historical reality, the place in the world, in my political community, where I am born and where I find myself, that's actually very important for Aquinas when speaking about justice, because there we are attaining to the real relationships in which I exist and with respect to which I need to be just. So a human being comes into the world as the child of parents, living in a human community, as a creature under God. He has not generated or created this order or these relationships. So man necessarily and inevitably exists in an interlocking web of other relationships, of being a part in a larger whole, his family, his clan, his city, the whole human race. And these are not constituted by his choice. We could say that man is naturally and originally in these relationships. Now, this is quite different from accounts of justice that are derived from social contract theory, especially that postulate like a primitive state of nature as a kind of historical postulate from which individuals then by choice enter into a set of relationships, say a relationship in a civil community. Theories like that, which we might think of Hobbes or Locke or even John Rawls here, are abstracting from the concrete historical relationships we are all, in fact, born into. And they aim at an account of justice which is then, in a way, abstracted from reality. For Aquinas, rather, we are just with respect to the real relationships that we exist in, not by choice. It has to do with the right ordering within us with respect to these realities that are outside of us. Okay, this brings us to part two. What gives this use its binding force? In question 57 of the Secunda Secundae, Aquinas lays out three traditional grounds for use, which are termed in Latin jus naturale, jus positivum, and jus gentium. So natural right, positive right, and the right of nations, or the law of nations, depending on your translation. So let's start off by distinguishing the first two. These are not terribly complicated, but helpful to draw out to clarify their distinctions. Natural right designates how a use or thing that is due is grounded in the nature of things themselves, and the equalization to which justice tends. It's obligatory by nature itself, by the nature of the thing. And it's anterior, it's before human agreement or convention. So here, once again, maybe it's worth pausing for a moment and excluding some common misunderstandings about what kind of nature we're talking about when, or what natural means in this context when we talk about natural right. The first misunderstanding here, which you might trace back to the 18th century, is to take the opposition between natural right and positive right in an essentially historical sense. On this view, natural right characterizes the primitive state of humanity before man enters into civil society. And then positive right would be later. That's not what Aquinas is speaking about when he's talking about natural right versus positive right, as I hope is already clear. Another misunderstanding posits a radical distinction or even opposition between, on the one hand, the natural world understood as a kind of physically determined reality, and on the other hand, the domain of freedom. Think of those who think that it is an ultimate act of freedom to be liberated from the natural constraints of your genetic sex, so that you, in your freedom, determine whether you are a man or a woman. This way of thinking about nature is to think of it as a kind of raw material without a moral value, and the moral value really comes from your unconstrained choice determining the meaning of your own existence. Now, that's also not what Aquinas is talking about when he's talking about nature. Nature is a much richer idea for Aquinas. How then to understand Aquinas when he talks about natural right? For Aquinas, natural right belongs to the moral order, which means it's set within or against the backdrop of the metaphysical order of being, and that it incorporates a teleological understanding of human nature, while at the same time always remembering that human nature always exists in a concrete historical order. So how is natural right related to natural law, which we've heard a fair amount about already? Just to recall briefly, or to repeat, it's always helpful to repeat these fundamental truths. Every creature receives a certain nature ordered to its characteristic operations, bearing within it certain natural inclinations that lead it to its end. We just heard that very nicely explained by Dr. Long. And rational creatures participate in the providential ordering of God's eternal law by grasping what is good for them in view of the kind of creatures that they are. What is their end? And therefore ordering themselves through their actions to that end. So that's our participation in the eternal law, which we can call natural law. Natural right looks at the same reality, but approaches it from another angle. It speaks about now the objective due or right or use that a man, as rational, should acknowledge insofar as he grasps himself as naturally constituted in diverse orders of relationships to his family, to his neighbors, to his fellow citizens, to all other human beings. So because of man's nature and the ends, or the ultimate end for which man is made, what man ought to be, we now can draw conclusions about what is due or what is just in the way that we treat other persons. Okay, this is where we get jus naturale. What is the jus positivum, or positive right, then? Just as natural right is correlated with natural law, so positive right correlates with positive law, the affirmative determinations made by a lawmaker. So natural right only obliges us with respect to what is good or evil in itself. So contraventions of natural right are wrong because they are evil. But positive right does not deal with things that are in themselves right or wrong, but things that are decided by convention or by agreement. So driving on the left-hand side of the road in the United States is not wrong in itself, But it's prohibited because it's a determination of the positive law that this is how we're going to order our traffic patterns. So you might think of the distinction used in jurisprudence between malum in se and malum prohibitum. So there's a nice little way to put this. Something malum in se, or contrary to natural right, is prohibited by the positive law because it's wrong. In contrast, something that is a malum prohibitum, or contrary to positive right, is wrong because it's prohibited. So natural right is obviously first and fundamental in two respects. First, it creates and founds the positive right, which can never contradict the jus naturale. And here you have text D and E, which I'm not going to read for the sake of time. That's kind of the first basis for natural right. And also that the positive law extends the natural law and makes it more precise. It determines it, both with respect to drawing conclusions and then just making determinations that are not necessarily directly concluded from the general principles of the natural law, but which are useful. So, for example, there's nothing in the natural law about driving on the right-hand side of the road. But it is right that the public authority make some determination about the traffic patterns. So the conclusion, the particular conclusion that we should drive on the right-hand side of the road is not part of natural law. But the fact that the authority would make such a determination, that does actually belong to the jus naturale. Now, it's not always easy to determine where the border is between natural right and positive right. Aquinas says that we grasp the general principles of natural law most clearly, but we're not always so clear about the conclusions that follow from them. And in the same way, that's true in trying to discern whether a particular civil law, for example, is binding on us because it is of the natural law or it is just a positive determination. But in any case, the positive law is important for making those determinations. This brings us to the third ground for jus, which I'll just touch on briefly, which comes not from Aristotle, but from Roman law, the jus gentium. It may seem close to natural right, but for Aquinas it's not simply the same. Here we're talking about the law of nations or the right of nations. And what's interesting about this is that it actually shows us that Aquinas is very sensitive to a kind of historical evolution of our consciousness about the reality of the natural law. So the jus gentium is not simply the natural law. It is the way we have, over time, recognized conclusions about the natural law. I'm summarizing what could be a longer discussion about this. But since that's not so important, let's move on to the final section of my talk, which is about the different species or parts of justice. Aquinas establishes a double division of the parts of justice. First, there is general justice or legal justice, which we've already heard some about from Dr. Long. Aristotle says that general justice is the whole of virtue. Now, that's a statement we can question exactly what he means by that or how to understand that. Aquinas repeats Aristotle's statement but gives it a kind of distinctive interpretation, which is itself controversial in some quarters. For Aquinas, this general justice, or justice understood as the whole of virtue, all of virtue, is a way of referring to legal justice. And legal justice is the species of justice that directs us, and consequently all of our acts of virtue, to the common good. So the jus in legal justice belongs to the community, which is really a community of persons. It's not just like an abstract reality, the state. Aquinas is clear about that. But it doesn't belong to just one person as an individual, which should be quite clear from Dr. Long's talk. Then there is a second division, or a second part. So you have general or legal justice, which orders, which is with respect to the individual as related to the common good. Then you have particular justice, where the use is held by an individual person. So that's the distinction. In particular justice, we have two subdivisions, and that is relations that are person to another individual person, that's commutative justice, and common good to person, that's distributive justice. So there you see the use belongs to the individual, but it's with respect to the common good vis-a-vis the individual. So this means that there's really a three principal species of justice that Aquinas talks about, which you can think about in a way analogous to the way things can be in a place. Think, just to use a kind of very crude example, of stones making up a house. You have the order of the parts to the whole. That's legal justice, individual to the common good. Then you have the order of the whole to the parts. That's distributive justice. And then you have the order of the parts to each other, their relation, you know, two stones in a wall. And that's commutative justice. Okay, so let's now say a little bit more about these three species of justice. So legal justice directs the parts to the whole. So it's the virtue of the citizen with respect to the common good. And you see in text F that Aquinas does not think that we are just being ordered to an abstraction, the common good as an abstraction here. We're actually being ordered to the community of persons, not to the state, but to a multitude of persons. And he says that this pertains to justice in the proper sense, secundum proprium rationem. So this means that we really owe something in justice to the common good. That's something that is often minimized in the American context, where we tend to think of the common good in a very thin way, and we also tend to think, well, if we can, you know, if we could get away with not paying our taxes, well, that would be nice, and I'd sort of like to do that. No, in fact, you have a real obligation in justice to the common good, and that is justice properly so called. So it's not only in our nature to live in groups as animals do, like in a pack or in a herd, but to live in a society, an ordered community, that has as its goal something higher and nobler than mere survival or coexistence, and that's the true good of the citizens, all the things that we just heard about from Dr. Long. Okay, now, distributive justice. This is the next species of justice, particular justice, which directs the whole to the parts. It concerns how the common good can be participated in by the individual. So this isn't only a matter of handing out shares of the pizza. So yes, there is a certain sense in which we can think of a pizza as a common good, and we're just going to divide up these material pieces and hand them out. But that's not principally what Aquinas has in mind, although sometimes that does happen, and it would fall under distributive justice if we're talking about like welfare payments or something like that. It could be also a matter of honors or according a certain rank or position of responsibility to someone. Think of, for example, what the federal government gives to you, and compare that to what the federal government gives to the President of the United States. The President lives in a big white house. He has a paid staff around him all the time. He has a chef, a limousine, he has bodyguards, all of that. He has a 747. And none of us get any of these things from the federal government. Is that unjust? Well, no, not necessarily. The President has a distinct place in the political order, he has care of the common good in a way different from the way we do. So in a way, it is just that the President receive more than I receive. So the mean in distributive justice is not arithmetic. It's proportional. It's based on some trait, status, rank, merit of the person we are talking about. There's a more quotidian example of this, you might think, and we all do it all the time. Think of a a third grade teacher who is trying to run this classroom of 30 kids, and there's one child who is always behind or has special attention. In fact, the teacher does generally spend more time with that student, and that may be just as a matter of distributive justice, that not all the students get the same amount of the teacher's attention. This one needs more, so gets more. Note also that punishment, criminal punishment, is a part of distributive justice for Aquinas. It's meted out by one who has care for the common good in order to restore the order of parts to the common good that were disordered by a criminal act. So we could talk about that for a long time, but we'll just have to keep moving here. But it's helpful to see criminal justice in a way fits there, in one sense, in another sense, under commutative justice. Aquinas doesn't just think of, oh, you have civil justice and criminal justice. It's these relationships that he's analyzing. Okay, the third species, commutative justice. This regulates individuals to individuals. Now, the paradigmatic case for commutative justice is a commercial exchange. I buy pumpkins from you, and I give you, I don't know, say I'm a cobbler, I give you shoes in exchange. How many pumpkins do I deserve for a pair of shoes? Here, the mean is arithmetic according to a right proportion or measure. It doesn't depend on who you are and who I am. It depends on the exchange that we are engaged in. And for Aquinas, commutative justice covers both voluntary exchanges like that and involuntary exchanges. So if you take something from me without my consent, you take my shoes, or any other use that I have, which could be my right to life or bodily integrity or my right to worship God or so forth, then you have taken something that was mine, that belonged to me, and that, therefore, the rectification of that act of injustice between two individuals is an act of commutative justice. So justice calls for restitution, which is the restoration of the use that was taken away. Now, that isn't, by the way, just punishment. That is a part of commutative justice, adjusting the relations between the individuals. The punishment is really with respect to the common good. Okay, there's a vast complexity and scope that Aquinas gives to this area, and you could map out all the different ways that you can take something that is due to another and get a kind of taxonomy of crimes and sins. So, for example, you have offenses against a person's life. Aquinas puts that in murder. These all come in the Treatise on Justice under commutative justice. You could commit a crime against his bodily integrity, mutilation or assault, against his free movement, imprisonment, against his goods, theft and robbery, against his good name. Here we have reviling, backbiting, tale-bearing, derision, something every good Catholic should know the distinctions between them. And against market exchanges, so cheating, usury. Okay, a quick clarification here. Not every act of the President of the United States, the head of state, is an act of distributive justice. Don't make that mistake. He will engage in some acts with respect to legal justice or general justice when he is deciding something that touches directly on the common good. Some of his acts will be as an individual. He goes and buys ice cream from a street vendor outside the White House. He has to pay for it like everybody else. That's an act of commutative justice. If he decides whether the ice cream vendor sells the best ice cream in the city and therefore deserves an award for the best ice cream, like the president's medal for ice cream, that is an act of distributive justice. So you can see how those different orders, the same person can engage in acts with respect to these different orders. Okay, the final little thing that I wanted to talk about is with respect to the potential parts of justice. These are virtues annexed to justice because they are akin to it. Even though they're not a species of justice, in the full sense. So Aquinas groups them under justice, even though each one of them does not fully conform to the definition of justice. And I've given you at the end of the handout there a list of the 8 potential parts of justice. So potential part is just a term that Aquinas uses to refer to something that has a kinship to justice but doesn't fully satisfy the definition. So religion, you render what is due to God. The thing there is, you can never give God as much as you owe him. So you can't be just to God, but there's a kind of justice where you give what is due to God. Okay, piety. This is what you render to your parents or to your country. And once again, you can never give enough because your parents are the very foundation of your being. Or you've received your existence through the mediation of your parents. Observance. This is where you give what is due to those who are in a position of dignity, Aquinas says. And he gives some examples. Parents and country in a certain sense, but the governor of the state, the commander of an army, and he adds, your teacher in matters of learning. That's important for all of you to remember. You should have a kind of reverence for your teachers. I suppose we should not be vainglorious about that, but in any case, the next one, gratitude, that's towards benefactors. Vengeance, surprising to find in a list of virtues. This is the infliction of a penalty or a punishment on one who sins. Now, you're not doing that because you want to see the person suffer. You're doing that out of a desire to rectify the relationship for the sake of the common good. And that is a virtue. Truthfulness. One manifests the truth to another according to a certain equality. You owe the truth, in a way, in your speech. Affability, or friendliness. This is a kind of virtue of friendliness. We've all perhaps had the experience of having, you know, maybe you work in an office with somebody who's just always grumpy and difficult to be around, and it makes everything harder. Affability is the virtue by which you are friendly, polite, civil, good-mannered, and that is a virtue where you in a way give something that is due to the people around you. And liberality or generosity, you're generous with money and with goods. You spend them freely. You make a good use of your money. Okay, one final point, and then I'll conclude. After enumerating these potential parts, Aquinas then talks about equity. And he says, actually, equity is also a species of justice. In a way, he's returning to the very beginning of his whole treatment of justice when he takes up equity. What is equity? It's a part of general justice, and it obtains in cases where the law as written should not be enforced for reasons of justice. So here you have texts G and H. He says, human actions consist in contingent singulars and are innumerable in their diversity. So it was not possible to lay down rules of law that would apply to every single case. Equity is, above all, the act of the person with the virtue of justice who is just and will be able to judge aright what is just in this situation when the positive written law no longer corresponds to what is just. And that's why we should hope for virtuous officials and judges to have charge of the common good. I'll end with just one final observation, and this is really to tie us back into the excellent presentation of Dr. Long about the common good. Justice is not the summit of politics or of civic life. It's a minimal condition for civic life or political life. And Aquinas agrees with Aristotle that the goal or the end of the political community is not just safeguarding just relations between the citizens, although that is a part of it. It actually goes further so that men will live well, so that they will live according to virtue, ultimately so that they will attain to their end. We might think here of the good of friendship also, which surpasses the measure of justice. We're not just to our friends. We have a different relationship to our friends than merely justice. It's a relationship of charity. And that opens a lot of avenues for further reflection. but that doesn't belong to this talk. So with that, I will simply say thank you.
Thank you. I have what I think is a fairly specific question. It has to do with justice with regard to wages, incomes, things like that. Now, I see this discussed among Catholics often under the heading of distributive justice. But I wonder, I'm just curious, is that the right category, or isn't it really, or is it rather a question of commutative justice, and it's just confused to talk about it as a matter of distributive justice or not?
I don't know that literature itself, but I would think that that's commutative justice. So in other words, this is actually an interesting point that I didn't note, but when Aquinas talks about natural right, the example he uses in 57.1 is very surprising. It's in the long text that I skipped over, text B. The example he uses is an exchange, which is not what we would think of. We would think that an exchange is just when it's the market price or something like that. Just economic theory has a hard time of even explaining why an exchange would be just outside of the fact that it's agreed to. But Aquinas does think that there is a kind of natural equivalence in the things, and that that pertains to the natural law. And therefore, you know, we can specify that by agreement, but if we're way out of line from what is the real value of those things, then we've done an injustice. And I think that's a question of commutative justice.
Thank you. So I'd like to ask actually about kind of a puzzling, for me at least, and I'm trying to understand, application of justice in the Prima Segunda of the Summa. So he says he's applying it now to Abraham and Isaac. And this is very different from politics, but anyway, it's under justice. He says, similarly, Abraham, when he consented to kill his son, did not consent to murder because it was due him to be killed through the command of God, who is Lord of life and death, for it is he who inflicts the penalty of death on all men, just and unjust, for the sin of the first parent. And if a man is the executor of this sentence by divine authority, then he will not be a murderer, just as God will not be. And so the interpretation of this by a secondary source says that Abraham was, just cooperating with God's justice. And so what does this mean? Like, is this justice under one of the potential parts, or what's your opinion?
That's a very good question. I'm not sure that I have a good answer for you offhand. I maybe should ask for help from the audience, where we have many other learned people. I mean, it seems to me that what is happening there is you have to think of the order that's involved, and since God is the one establishing the order according to his wisdom, we are not in a position to say, oh, wait a second, that God is, like, what you're doing now is out of sync. You can't, you know, I'm not going to comply with that part. I've got the rule manual here, and that's not in here. Because, in fact, we have an insufficient appreciation of that order. I think that is, in a way, the way Aquinas would have to approach it, to see that as an act of justice. I suppose it's an act of, it's an act of legal justice, I imagine, that Abraham is conforming to the common good. I mean, what happens when a human executioner obeys the command of the judge to impose the right sentence of, you know, suppose that there's a just sentence of death in a particular case. Is the executioner engaging in an act of distributive justice? I guess insofar as he's meting out the punishment, but insofar as he's obeying the command of the judge, I think that perhaps is legal justice.
Father, may I weigh in on this
for
just a moment? So Aquinas has these passages in the Old Testament he has to deal with, where you have the Abraham, the Kierkegaardian question. Kierkegaard says it's the teleological suspension, the ethical. Aquinas does not follow him down that road. And so wants to hold that there's not, that Abraham is not acting unethically. He also sees the passages about the ban, and there's also the famous case of the Egyptian children who were killed by God in the plague. Okay, so Aquinas, I think, does put this under the virtue of religion, because there's nothing we have that we don't owe God, and so there's an absolute prohibition on our taking innocent human life, and so the Pharaoh is rightly condemned for committing genocide of the children of the Hebrews, because he does not have the divine prerogative to take life that he believes he has as an avatar of the divinity, idolatrously. But God does have the providential governance of all human life in his hands, and may take the Egyptians' children's lives as a chastisement without any injustice towards the Egyptians. In fact, it's a retribution and in some ways an education of them. Now, that's a very strong position Aquinas takes, but it does allow you to show that God, as the giver of the plenitude of all being of things and their lives, is the sovereign principle of reference, which relativizes human pretensions to power over life. And it allows you to show the transcendent justice of God, which is not as, you know, sometimes as forcibly stated in the New Testament or stated differently. The harder question becomes when God designates or delegates by special revelation human agents to be those who carry out the delineations of his transcendent justice. And that does not really occur outside of revelation, so that if you came to me in confession and said, well, you know, an angel told me to kill my child, I would take you to the mental health clinic and I would have you forcibly restrained and I might have your child taken away from you. But in the economy of the Old Testament, it is to be believed that God did at times manifest transcendent justice in these very particular circumstances through these. And then you get into the question of why he would do that in archaic culture and what that's teaching us. Of course, some people want to just say these are dark passages of the Bible that aren't per se inspired. Aquinas does not follow them down that road. He does want to say these are manifestations of the transcendent justice of God through human delegates that are rare. And then in Abraham's case, of course, it's to show as the founder of the covenant that the one person through whom the whole covenant has to pass, which is Isaac, can be offered to God in an act of, as it were, you know, blind allegiance of faith, and God will still providentially accord mercy to Abraham for the sake of his faith. Okay, so it's a very particular circumstance. I think it's very important for Catholics, as much as I don't want to ever, you know, like, I don't think we want to derogate from the manifestation of the transcendent justice of God in those cases. We also don't want to universalize them as, you know, taking the hardest cases as universal law and feeling we have to defend that either. I don't want to derail the discussion.
Yeah, no,
I don't want to get on this conversation. So let's go back to justice in general. Okay.
And I'm sure Father White meant to say in the sacristy, not in the confessional, because you couldn't take someone to the hospital from the confessional.
Right. I wouldn't violate the seal. That's right. I might try to get you to talk to me outside of the confessional.
Seems that animals don't have rights in themselves as animals, but it also seems that humans have duties toward animals. My question is the foundation of those duties, if it's based on our relationship with God as the creator of the animals, or what exactly is the foundation, as you see it?
Yeah, I think that's also a very good question. So we, insofar as, we could say that insofar as they are beings that can sense pain, it would be wrong for us, the disorder would be in us, if we caused pain intentionally to those animals. But obviously, it can't be that we simply cannot cause any pain to them, because if you're gonna eat animals, you're going to cause some pain to them. So they don't have a kind of claim on us in justice in that respect. So I think you could think about it in terms of respecting the order of God's creation. And therefore, you have a kind of, you know, it's being ordered to God and their place in as part of the common good, or something like that. And that cruelty towards animals would involve a moral depravity in us, as opposed to thinking that it's somehow a right owed to the animal in justice. That's, I guess, the direction I'd want to go. But I admit that I haven't thought carefully about this.
Thanks very much for a great talk. I'm curious as to what you would say about the relationship between coercion in law and the idea of justice, and as it pertains particularly to the human law, and especially with regards to your last point about the potential parts of justice. Are they necessary at all for the human law? Can't Aquinas say everything he wants to say about the nature of a political and legal community on the basis of coercion alone? One could be coerced to act in a way that brings about the common good, but one can't be coerced to be affable, for instance.
Yeah. So those are not virtues of justice, strictly speaking. They don't necessarily belong to the political community properly. Maybe I should be careful about that. Maybe Dr. Long will correct me about whether affability is a kind of civic virtue, if you think about it. Like, we do want a healthy political community to have a kind of, not have boorish behavior in public, which is detrimental to our common life, in a way. But to go back to your question about coercion, so you might think about punishment here, because punishment is maybe standing behind the civil law's threat of coercion. I mean, that's how we're coerced, either by a punishment with respect to a fine or imprisonment or some other penalty that we suffer. And Aquinas does think that that is a part of the role of authority, that it's necessary for the safeguarding of the common good. And, interestingly, he also thinks about this in terms of our relationship to God. So the punishment that is due to sin is just and actually good for us, even though we don't like it, because it's ordering us to the common good, even against our will. So in a certain sense, if you think about even eternal damnation, it's a way for Aquinas to say that everyone, in the end, will be ordered to God. The only question is whether that's voluntary or involuntary. And if you're involuntarily ordered to God, it's punishment.
I take two more questions.
I'm going to interject a line of poetry from Jared Manley Hopkins. The just man justices, acts in God's eye what in God's eye he is, Christ. For Christ plays in 10,000 places, lovely in eyes and lovely in limbs not his, to the Father, through the features of men's faces. Now, I've been mystified by the just man justices. He takes the word justice and he makes a verb out of it. And the sense that we are just, God justifies us, it is another sense of justice that we haven't really touched on. I wondered if you might comment on that.
Yes, that's a beautiful passage. And actually, the poet there is calling, by using a word in a way that we're not used to, he's making us aware of what that means, to justify. And that is exactly the way Aquinas talks about justification. So Christ, who is the just man, makes us just. How does he do it? He makes us just by restoring our order to God. So once again, you have justice understood as an order and this relationality. We are, when we're sinners, out of order to God, and justification restores that ordering. And how it works principally is through the rectification of our wills in the gift of charity, by which now we willingly regard God as our greatest, as our perfect good, as the greatest. You know, we will God's goodness in itself for its own sake, and so we order all of our other activities in reference to that highest good. And that is to be justified, or to be made right, you might say, to be made upright.
Straightened out.
Yeah.
The word straight also has...
That's right.
We're going to have a final question here.
Yes, I just wanted to jump in on the business whether Aquinas can say everything he needs to say about law in terms of coercion, because the very nature of law as an ordinance of reason is such that the chief efficacy of it is in directing intelligence as governing action. And it's only secondarily that coercion comes in. In other words, if I were to come in here and think the only thing keeping all of you from murdering me in the middle of my talk is fear of coercion, I would think I was living in an uncivilized state. So the law has an instructive or hortatory aspect to it, and in a society in which people cannot reasonably receive what is being given to them, the law is inefficacious. I mean, imagine what kind of success you're going to have in Pakistan, decreeing that people have to eat hot dogs three times a day. Good luck with that. So in other words, there is an intrinsic moral, rational constituent here, and the chief efficacy is in addressing that, but at the margins, it must be coerced precisely because of the necessity. Well, because you could have something that is putatively law, which is simply unjust. In the same way, you can have something that is in the body, which is a tumor, and you have to find some way to mitigate that harm, or if you can remove the tumor without harming the body, you do that. Similarly, with an unjust law, it's not enough for someone simply to say, we have decreed that transsexualism is a new ontology, which has been promulgated by the Supreme Court or something.
Please help me thank Father Legge.